But tonight, I have the great pleasure once again to announce the talk, or introduce the talk, by my friend Jim Wilson, who has given many talks in this space over the years. This one, we get to hear his voice, not just as a Buddhist teacher or practitioner, but as a poet, and reading his own poetry and the poetry of others in the Tanka form. There's much more I could say, but I think I'll leave it to Jim's voice tonight. Thank you so much, Jim. It's on.
Thank you very much for coming tonight. It's good to see you all on this auspicious evening. You know, like several months ago when I scheduled this evening, I had no idea that this was Obama night. I'm impressed. I honestly thought that no one would show up. So thank you, for spending this evening here. I'm going to talk about a Japanese form called Tanka. and also forms that sprang out of Tanka, as Tanka evolved over the millennia. It is the oldest form of Japanese poetry. It has a written history of between 1300 and 1400 years, and it has been continuously practiced all that time, which is amazing. I don't know of another form of poetry that has been continuously practiced. There probably is somewhere in the world, because I'm not familiar with every culture, that sort of thing. But it's impressive that a form of poetry has been continuously practiced for all that time. The written history is 1300 to 1400 years old, but it's probably older than that, because in the oldest anthologies, some of the Tanka are folk songs, that have been collected and have an older history than that. You will find Tanka in the Kojiki and the Nihongi, and the Kojiki is the earliest mythic record of Japan, and the Nihongi is the earliest quasi-historical, or it's more historically focused than the Kojiki. It is amazing how Tanka has permeated Japanese society. For example, in the Tale of Genji, which is called the first Japanese novel, and some people regard it as the first historic novel in history, it's 1,000 years old this year, incidentally. They're celebrating in Japan the thousandth year of the Tale of Genji. In the Tale of Genji, there are almost 800 tanka. And the way this is done is that one of Genji's lovers will write to him a tanka, and he will respond with another tanka, back and forth, back and forth. Sometimes one of his lovers will send him three lines, and he will immediately cap the verse, is how Murasaki Shikibu puts it, and put in the closing two lines, or vice versa. There's also been translated a work called the Kagero Diary. The woman who wrote the Kagero Diary never mentions her name, and there's some dispute about exactly who she was. But her diary is in the form of tanka. It's almost entirely tanka, with just a few interlineal passages. And she records the tanka the people sent to her, and how she responded, and then they responded with another tanka. So for educated people in Japan, fairly early on, writing tanka became almost second nature. It's really quite amazing, how pervasive it was, which makes me nervous talking about it, because the amount of tanka material that has been translated into English is, I've become aware, is like this tiny, tiny micro sliver of this vast, vast, huge, enormous tradition. So anything I say about tanka, please take with a pound of salt, not just a grain of salt. The form of tanka has been consistent throughout Japanese history, and that is 31 syllables divided into five sections in the pattern 5-7-5-7-7. I'm going to use the word syllables. Please be aware that Japanese syllables and English syllables are kind of different horses, but for our purposes this evening, it's close enough. and it's been even down to contemporary times. That is the pattern. Japan has known other forms of poetry, and they come and go. And the Tonka River continues to flow. it's really fascinating. They experimented for many centuries with Chinese forms of poetry. And there's wonderful collections of Chinese poetry done by Japanese. Chinese poetry was pervasive in East Asia. There's collections of Koreans who wrote Chinese-style poetry as well. But tanka is considered by Japanese to be their quintessential form. That's the heart of their poetic tradition. Tanka did not come to the West really until the last 20 years. It's really very new in the United States. There's some precursors to that, but it got off to a later start than the better known haiku. And partly I think the reason is that the Japanese consider tanka to be so intimately a part of their culture that they were kind of reluctant to teach tanka to non-Japanese. There's in William Higginson's haiku handbook, he has a brief paragraph on tanka, and he says it's not possible to write it in English. It's just too interwoven into Japanese culture, and that was a very widely held view for quite a while, but in the last 20 years or so, there has been an upsurge in interest. I think one of the reasons for that is that tanka is very much involved with the heart and the expression of emotion. Haiku tends to be much more objective, and actually the expression of emotion in haiku is considered to be a flaw. And if you go to Japan and you study under a haiku teacher, and you write something emotional, then that will be marked, and you'll be told to try again. But tanka have always had a rich emotional life. So in the earliest anthologies of tanka, there are many chapters devoted to love, loss, yearning, all those kinds of feelings. And since many poets tend to want to express their emotional lives, tanka has an appeal to some. Incidentally, please feel free to ask questions or comments. This is very informal. I'd like to start out by just touching on reading a few tanka from the oldest collection of Japanese poetry extant, which is called the Manyoshu. The Manyoshu is... when was the Manyoshu? 8th century. Manyoshu means 10,000 leaves, 10,000 is an East Asian expression for lots of. And there are about 4,500 poems, of which a large percentage are tanka. Not all of them are tanka, but a large percentage are tanka. So this is one from Empress Jito, and she lived from 645 to 702. On the northern hills, now there trails a band of cloud, a blue cloud drifting, drawing away from the star, drawing away from the moon. So it's a landscape, I like, so I'll read it again. On the northern hills, now there trails a band of cloud, a blue cloud drifting, drawing away from the star, drawing away from the moon. I'm just going to read a few of these ancient ones because I want to give a feeling from where the Tantra tradition sprang from. One of the most of the poets collected in the Manyoshi we know almost nothing about, unless they happen to be an empress, you know, then we know from the historical record. The first poet that begins to have like a personality and seems to, you know, take on a certain like identifiable technique was a poet by the name of Hitomaro, and he lived in the 8th century. And there are quite a few of his poems in the Manyoshu, and he's generally considered by the Japanese to be sort of like the first identifiable poet personality in Japan. So I thought I would read a few. He's still greatly admired. You know, like, in the sea of sky, the waves of cloud rise up, and the moon boat is seen rowing out of sight into the forest of stars. So that refers to a holiday in Japan where there's a, what is the name of that holiday? There are these two stars which are represent two lovers who were parted. And then one night a year, the stars get to meet, you know, like, and they row this boat across the Milky Way. You know, like, and so he's referring, it's actually a love poem. You know, like, so, in the sea of sky, the waves of cloud rise up, and the moon boat is seen rowing out of sight into the forest of stars. Another one by Hitomaro. We are like foam on rushing water roaring through mountain gorges under Makimuku, we who are people of this world. It's a very common theme, a theme of impermanence. The earliest poems in Manyoshu are all very celebratory, kind of have a very kind of pagan feel to them, you know, like a love of nature. And you can detect the Buddhist influence coming in, you know, like with the as the history of Tanka unfolds, there's a much greater emphasis on impermanence and the passing away of things and the ephemerality of things. You know, like, we are like foam on rushing water roaring through mountain gorges under Makimuku, we who are people of this world. Makimuku is a famous waterfall in Japan. Over Mount Kui, where in the spring the horses graze, the sound comes closer. The lone messenger goose of fall passes my lodging in the night. This is a very early example of a technique called the pivot. Like, so it divides the poem into two parts, which you can barely, you know, when you read it, it has a unity, but here's how it works. Over Mount Kui, where in spring the horses graze, the sound comes closer. That's an image. So the horses are grazing and the sound of the horses is coming closer. Or, the sound comes closer, the lone messenger goose of fall passes my lodging in the night. So that phrase, the sound comes closer, acts as a pivot that unites the two images. And that has become a pervasive technique of Tanka. You know, like, for some traditions of Tanka in Japan, it's actually considered definitive. Like, if you don't have a pivot, you know, like, your teacher will go, you know, missing a pivot. But it's pivot is not universal. You know, like, but you should look for it when you read Tanka. It has a very, it's very effective. You know, like, it's one of the ways such a short poem can become complex and sort of create reverberations. So here's a modern example of a pivot. This is a poem by Neil Henry Lawrence, who was one of the very first American tanka poets. I think he wrote in the 1970s and 80s, something like that. He died at the age of like 98 or 99, about 10 years ago. Just before sleeping, opening my eyes a bit, I saw the full moon through the unshuttered window, an incitement to sweet dreams. So the two parts, just before sleeping, opening my eyes a bit, I saw the full moon. I saw the full moon through the unshuttered window, an incitement to sweet dreams. See, both sections are complete images, and the pivot line links them together. This linking, you know, like from the earliest period of Japanese poetry, this linking was very significant, and it evolved over time into other forms of poetry. Not to compare myself to Hitomaro, but here's what here's one I wrote just recently, which. Yesterday I spoke to the memory of you as I was walking. Clouds moved in and covered the last rays of the August sun. Yesterday I spoke to the memory of you as I was walking. As I was walking, clouds moved in and covered the last rays of the August sun. So there you have the two images, you know, pulled together.
Except if each is a haiku.
The first three, you know, would be in 5, 7, and 5, and would be in the form of a haiku. You know, like, you know, in a formal sense, they would be like a haiku. Yeah. So the detachment of the first three lines has a long history about it, but I'll get to that when I get to Renga. Because it actually, the haiku didn't detach itself from tanka. It detached itself from another form of poetry, which is also derived from tanka. But yeah, you can see the setup there for the eventual, which eventually resulted in tanka. I mean, haiku. Yeah.
Is the link the third line in the haiku? If you see tanka as a haiku with 2 7-syllable lines, and the linking phrase is always what would have been the third line?
It's not always the third line.
That's what I want.
It can be the fourth line. It can be the second line. You know, like, it varies. And I'm told by, in an essay I read by Cranston, who's a great translator of Japanese tanka, that at certain periods in Japanese history, they would favor like the fourth line or the third line or the second line. You know, like that you can almost identify, you know, the period in which it was written by, you know, by where the link falls. Again, I do want to say not all tanka have this double structure. There are a lot of tanka that are written they're laudatory verses to a sovereign, a patron. Love poems written to the object of one's affection, they often have a single, you know, from beginning to end, have a single structure. You know, like, but this is distinctive of the way the Japanese approached tanka. Like, it's very common, and it's nice to look for it. You know, like, it helps you to understand, you know, like, what's going on. The other thing is that. Tanka, the two parts of a tanka don't always have a pivot. Sometimes they'll juxtapose two images without having a pivot. It's sort of like the pivot is implied, you know, like that they'll just be two images. You know, like, what would be an example?
Thank you.
I'll run into one and I'll show it to you. So, but those are also my understanding of what's behind these two parts is what I call resonance. It isn't that one part is a metaphor for the other. All right. Rarely, the Japanese will use an explicit metaphor. They'll use the word like, you know, or as in, you know, something like that. But it's very rare. The view is that what is going on in one's emotional life is similar. Is similar to what is going on in the world of nature. They're resonant with each other. It's kind of what in Western occult traditions was called as above, so below. You know, like, so there's a synchronicity of what is happening in the world and in what is happening in one's interior life. You know, like, so it isn't that one is like, it's not my love is like a red, red rose. It's if, you know, if I see my love and I also see a red, red rose, or my feelings about my love and a red, red rose have a resonance. You know, like, does that make sense what I'm saying? It's a little different from a structured metaphor. Another one by Hitomaro. It grieves me that the day at length grows dark despite my wish to gaze yet more on Yoshino's clean river beach, for I am never weary of the sight. So, a lot of Japanese tanka are landscape, you know, like, and it's kind of this Shinto feeling of the landscape as a divine domain. You know, like, so you get this sort of feeling of imminence, you know, from the landscape. Tell my beloved that I wait my boat in the water at Yasu Crossing, ready the moment autumn comes to launch upon the river in the sky. Be it when it may, I have never a moment free from this longing, but when evening comes upon me, I am helpless in my love. love poetry is a big part of tanka. There tend to be three aspects of love that tanka focuses on. One is the initial thrill of the meeting, you know, the infatuation, you know, like, oh, this is wonderful, you know, this is just, it's so great, you know, like, and then the first moment of maybe this isn't so great, you know, like that kind of, you know, like that kind of, and a lot of poems about waiting, you know, like he said or she said that, you know, he would be here and I'm waiting and I wonder what he's doing and that sort of thing, and then the fourth one, the third one is loss, either. Parting, you know, like, because it's not, hasn't worked out, you know, like, or the death of a loved one, you know, that kind of expression. You know, like. Very, very rarely do you find what we would call explicitly erotic, you know, like, or, you know, like, softcore tanka. Very, very rare. You know, it's usually focused on these emotional states. You know, like. The last poet I'm going to read is Akahito, and he lived 724 to 730. I mean, he wrote and was active as a poet from 724 to 736, and he's often compared to Hitomaro. When from Tago's shore we rowed far out and turned to look, pure white it was, the towering cone of Fuji gleaming under fallen snow. Fuji's a big Fuji's a big deal in Japanese tanka, especially the earlier period. You know, like, some geologists say that Fuji was still smoking at the time many of these very early poems about Fuji were written. The old embankment, relic of a vanished past, the deepening years, along the margin of the pond lie buried in the tangled reeds. It's just an image. You know, like this one is a little, it's interesting. This isn't like Heat Tomorrow. This is a little more nebulous. You know, like you're just supposed to get a feeling from this. The old embankment, relic of a vanished past, the deepening years, along the margin of the pond lie buried in the tangled reeds. And finally, all across the fields, high upon the footsore hills, the huntsmen can be seen, excitedly advancing with their game bows in their hands. So the name for this is in Japanese is sachet, which means sketch from life. And in the early 20th century, there was a poet, what was his name? The haiku poet?
Santoka.
No, I'm not talking about Santoka, but he did do sachet. I'm trying to remember. He invented the word haiku and...
Shiki.
Thank you. Masaoka Shiki. He wrote several essays about sachet, and it became kind of a movement, you know, like... But sachet means sketch from life. You know, like it's just kind of like taking a very objective sketch of what you see. You know, like so all across the fields, high upon the footsore hills, the huntsmen can be seen, excitedly advancing with their game bows in their hands. Now notice the two-part structure. All across the fields, high upon the footsore hills, the huntsmen can be seen. The huntsmen can be seen, excitedly advancing with their game bows in their hands. So the huntsman can be seen as the pivot which unites the two sections. A lot of Japanese write what we would call a taka diary, you know, like, and they use that sachet technique, you know, but they write, you know, like what has happened to them that day, or what they've observed, or their feelings about that day, but they'll put it into the tanka form. So it's a poetic diary. And what's interesting to me about, they get published in Japan. Some are more famous than others. There's a woman in Japan now who's hugely popular. Her tanka books sell millions. I'm sorry, I can't remember her name right now. And she, basically, her collections are from her tanka diaries. You know, like, and she takes a couple of years and publishes almost all of them. Really. And one of the interesting things to me about Japanese views about poetry collections is that they don't expect every poem to be brilliant. You know, like, it's really okay with them that there be some mediocre poems. You know, like, their view is this creates foreground and background, you know, like so that the really beautiful ones, you know, like come forward, and the mediocre ones are good. They're good enough, you know. It's all right for a person to write a good enough poem, you know. Like I think that's really interesting because the push in our culture is for each poem that you put in a collection to be, you know, memorable and a very high standard.
I have a question about, because I've been trying to hear the syllables. Uh-huh. Most English translations keep that form, or do some rather go with the spirit of the text because it means the syllables aren't right?
There's a huge variation among translators. These are all from Cranston and the book Waka Anthology on the back. Cranston is fairly committed to keeping the count, but he's not adamant about it. Not all of these are 57577, but he keeps it close. You know, like McCullough, who is a translator at Stanford, translated an anthology of over 1,100 poems, which I'll get to, called the Kokinshu, and every single poem she translated is in 57577. So, like, you know, she's committed to that. You know, like, other translators are not. you know, they're committed to what you call the spirit of the poem or the meaning of the poem. And they have conferences where they discuss this, you know, like, because McCullough's view is that part of the meaning of Tonka is the form, and her argument is that the form has been consistent for over 1,000 years. And so, you know, like for 1,300 to 1,400 years of written history, it's been consistent. And so she wants to reflect that, you know, like in other words, she's willing to sacrifice some meaning because she finds meaning in the form, you know, like, and others want to reflect, you know, like more what they call the heart, you know, like of the poem, and are willing to sacrifice, you know, like some of the structural elements.
Yeah. Is the meaning density per syllable in English similar to the Japanese? I mean, I know just in English, you know, if you take a look at Anglo-Saxon derived words, you get sweat. If you look at, you know, Latin ones, you get perspiration. So they mean the same thing, but a different number of syllables to get that. Is sort of the Anglo-Saxon words of English similar to Japanese? Do you know?
Well, it depends on whether you're talking about the phoneme level or the grammatical level. In the Japanese, syllables are very short compared to English, you know, like so. And they tend to be of uniform length. You know, like, and so, for example, the letter N at the end of a word, just a N, is a syllable. And they're not many English syllables that are that short. there's some, but that N sound is very, very common. Another is it's almost a glottal stop. It's like that sound is a syllable, you know, like in Japanese. You know, like we can hardly hear it, you know, like, and if we, like, the I'm using a very common verb, which means to be, des. If you see it written, it's D-E-S-U, and usually Americans will read it and go desu, you know, like, and Japanese think that's very funny, you know, like, so, you know, like, because really it sounds closer to what we would hear as des. You know, they almost swallow completely that U sound. So at that level, the Tonka in Japanese would be quicker, you know, it wouldn't last as long as 31 syllables in English. But Cranston wrote a really interesting essay, and he pointed out that's true at one level. At another level, Japanese does not use articles. It uses no, the, or a. You know, like, and it rarely uses pronouns, much less frequently than in English. They have pronouns, like watashi means I. You know, like, so it... But Japanese wouldn't use I in a sentence normally unless there's confusion. For example, if I wanted to say, I'm going to the store, not you, then I would say watashi. You know, like, but if I was just saying I'm going to the store, you know, like I was leaving the house, I would just say to the store or going to the store. I wouldn't normally use the pronoun. You know, like, so in English, you have two cases where the, you know, like the articles and pronominal usage is much greater in English. Translators like Cranston and McCullough feel that balances, you know, like, and so that you need the full 31 syllables in English because of those grammatical considerations, you know, like. And translators, once again, are very eloquent and articulate, and they're all over the map on this, you know, like, there's some who believe that English Tonka should be shorter to match the shortness of the Japanese. Mm-hmm. There's some who believe that the meaning density... See, the reason it depends, if you think of an English word as necessarily having an article, then that has to be included in the density. You know, like the article has to be included with the word.
Do you have any examples of the Tonka in Japanese that you could read?
Let's see.
Just to give us an idea of the swiftness of their progress.
There's nothing here. I don't, I'm sorry to say. I'm sure there's some on the back table, though, but I wasn't thinking along those lines, so I apologize. But, I have all these books here. Oh, let's see. Here we go. In English. After winter comes, there may be a rare break in the rain clouds, but even then no day goes by without showers of falling leaves. The Japanese. Fuyukita wa shigaruru kumo no tema dani yomo no konoba no furano hizunaki. I'm sure that's not a good pronunciation. Fuyukita wa shigaruru kumo no tema dani yomo no konoha no furano hizunaki.
I think one of the things that gets missed in the translation is the sonority of the Japanese, since it's an oral rich language. Right. It's very musical.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Japanese has almost no consonant groupings. It's, you know, consonant vowel, consonant vowel, consonant vowel. Every single Japanese word ends in a vowel or the letter N. One more example. The footprints are gone from my unvisited garden, the color of the moss now all but forgotten beneath fallen blossoms. Atotete toarenu niwa no koku no iro mo wasuru bakari ni niwa zo furishiku. Atotete toarenu niwa no koku no iro mo wasura bakari ni niwa zo furishiku. So it is shorter, isn't it? But, and probably if I was skillful, it would be even shorter. So the poems are short, you know, like they're quite short. Yeah, do you enjoy the poems though? I mean, there's a beauty to them. You know, a poet friend of mine by the name of Larry Gross said that a poetic form survives because it does something exceedingly well. You know, like, it's hard to say exactly what that something is, but you know, he was talking about tonka, villanelle, sonnet, things like that. There's something about those forms that people find enjoyable, or they relate to. There's a beauty in them when they're done right, of course. You know, like, and so there is a kind of Tonka has this, you know, it goes 5-7-5, and then it opens up into this cadential 7-7. You know, like, very. But the poems are short, and very early in Japanese history, they created anthologies by topic. The Manyoshu is an anthology by author, which is familiar to us, you know, an anthology of poems by author, you know, like. But in the, let's see, when was this? In the 10th century, around 905, there was an imperially commissioned anthology of Tonka, and it's called Kokinshu. That's the shortened form. The full form is Kokin Wakashu. And what the guy who put this all together, whose name was Tsuriyaki, he arranged the Tonka by subject. And so there's 20 chapters. There's not 20 subjects because, like, there's 2 chapters on spring, you know, 4 chapters on love, 2 chapters on autumn. But he arranged them in sequence. So let me just read the opening sequence for spring, the beginning, the first chapter of this collection. Springtime has arrived while the old year lingers on. What then of the year? Are we to talk of last year, or are we to say this year? On this first spring day, Might warm breezes be melting the frozen waters I scooped up, cupping my hands and letting my sleeves soak through? What are we to seek? The layered haze of springtime, while snow still falls in the hills of Yoshino, the hills of fair Yoshino. Springtime has arrived, while fallen snow lingers on. Ah, now, at long last, the warbler's frozen teardrops will surely be dissolving. And what he does is he starts out very early spring, I mean, really before spring, you know, like, and then there's the first hint of warmth because the warbler's frozen teardrops are going to be dissolving, you know, like, and he takes you through the whole season of spring, you know, like, and then you have the plums are blossoming, and then the cherries are blossoming, and it's set so that you get the full experience of spring. So at the end, in springtime, season of joyous bird choruses, new youth is granted, all living things, yet for me, there is no end of aging. Like, so, like, these are not by Tsuruyaki. These are all by different poets. You know, like, so here what you see is a linking of these, and what the Japanese do is they read a chapter, it's like a single poem. You know, like, so it's like a long poem, but by different authors. You know, like, and there's a real beauty. This set the standard, this particular anthology set the standard for all other anthologies subsequent to it. Had an enormous influence, like Rengetsu, your favorite. She memorized this. You know, like she, Laura did a talk, our first talk here this year, on a very famous Waka Tanka poet by the name of Rengetsu. When was she alive?
1860.
And right down to the present day, you know, Japanese tanka poets will study the Kokinshu and virtually memorize the entire 1,100 plus, you know, poems. And the result of this is that a lot of Japanese tanka have allusions to the Kokinshu, which completely elude us. You know, like, so some of these allusions will be very, you know, very subtle. You know, like, and it's part of their Japanese poetic culture. But I couldn't leave without doing the Japanese without doing a little bit of love poems. You know, like this is love poems from the Manyoshu. You know, like her voice sings like a bird beneath the leaves of a fall mountain. If she'd only speak to me, what would we have to grieve? Ah, if she were here, we could listen together on this ocean shore to the sound of passing cranes crying in the rising sun. Going out to sea and sailing along the coast, I hope to please you by catching from the seaweed a carp of sword handle size. So even in Japan, fishermen like to tell fables. From the high mountain, the cry of a crying stag carries down valleys. How inspiring is its voice, like yours, my loving Lord. Do not even ask, for I do not know the name of the man I love. Yet for him I stand and wait, all wet from the autumn dew. So there she is, waiting for him. You know, it's so, American tanka began in, like I say, about 20 years ago, and a really important pivotal person in the development of American tanka was Jane Reichel, who lives right up in Gualala. In the late 80s and early 90s, she sponsored a contest called Tanka Splendor. In which he encouraged people to send in tanka, and it became quite a lot of poets became very interested in it. You know, like, and she published a lot of tanka herself. And eventually this resulted, incidentally, in her being invited to Japan and being given an audience with the emperor, you know, like in some official honorary status, you know, like for all her work, you know, like for Japanese poetry. You know, like. And she published the first collection of, the first anthology of American tanka, and it's called Wind Five Folded. You know, like, so it's on the table back there. So thank you, Jane, you know, for all your efforts, like on behalf of tanka. So here's one from Wind Five Folded. Humid evening air, the crescent moon's thin outline, my anger thwarted by your coolness. I follow the bat's flight, wide, wild circles. Here's another one from Wind Five Folder. Rapids in the moonlight, like the starlit rush of hairs, making me quiver. The night's great circle of fire unquenchably flickers on. So American tanka is very diverse. You have there's a tanka poet right here. Like you have those who are very committed to 5-7-5-7-7. You have those who are more loose about it, and they use what I would call a loose formal approach: short, long, short, long, long. You know, like as long as it falls within that general frame. And then you have others who are more open than that. You know, like, and this is very typically American. You know, they're experimenting with the form, feeling their way, you know, like, and who knows what will come out of this. But really, we're just, you know, like, if you compare, like, the transmission of the sonnet from Italy to England, we're not at the age of Shakespeare or at the age of Wyatt, you know, like, people are just started, you know, with this form. It's kind of exciting, you know, like it's really nice. So now I will move on to a few of my tanka, and this one is called Quiet Night. On this quiet night, a night of many spirits, hours before the dawn, there are voices in the wind and songs sung among the stars. Another one. The grove of redwoods, silent, an ancient stillness, soothing and serene. I once saw a goddess there, eyes of night and starlight hair. I'm very fond of rhyme in tanka. I'm a little unusual that way. Most American tanka poets I know are not fond of rhyme. But I started writing tanka after diving into Emily Dickinson. You know, like, and Emily Dickinson loves rhyme, you know, like, but what she taught me is that it's possible to use rhyme in a very natural way, not a forced way, you know, like in a short poem, if you're not careful with rhyme, it sounds like almost like an ad or, you know, like a jingle of some kind, you know, like, but Emily Dickinson's poems don't sound like that, you know, like she's, you know, like all across the sky, Aurora Borealis and the tundra wind and the endless tundra night and the beating of my heart. So I lived in Alaska for quite a few years, so that's where that one comes from. I worked on the north coast of Alaska, so I can remember standing there and the aurora, you know, occasionally it's possible to see the aurora like in some place like Portland or Seattle, but they're on the horizon. When you're on the north coast of Alaska, they go across the whole sky, you know, like, you know, from one end to the other. They fill the sky. You know, it's amazingly beautiful. One of the word tanka is a very new word. Until the 20th century, tanka were referred to as waka, you know, like, and have a seat. And before that, they were referred to as uta, you know, like, and uta is a kind of a song. And And in the Manyoshu, some of them are labeled as songs. So that inspired me to make some tanka songs. So we're going to sing a song. Sing a song of tanka. Thank you. A very simple melody, nothing complex here. A few of you have heard this, I think, already, so you can follow along. So the melody goes. So what we'll do is we'll go through the three verses twice, and then we'll end up on the first verse. Okay. So let's try it. Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4. On this quiet night, a night of many spirits, hours before the dawn, there are voices in the wind and songs sung among the stars. The grove of redwoods, silent and ancient stillness, soothing and serene. I once saw a goddess there, eyes of night and starlight hair. Oh, all across the sky, Aurora Borealis, and the tundra wind, and the endless tundra night, and the beating of my heart. Oh, on this quiet night, a night of many spirits, hours before the dawn, there are voices in the wind and songs sung among the stars. Oh, the grove of redwoods, silent and ancient stillness, soothing and serene. I once saw a goddess there, eyes of night and starlight hair. Oh, all across the sky, Aurora Borealis, and the tundra wind, and the endless tundra night, and the beating of my heart. Quiet night, a night of many spirits, hours before the dawn, there are voices in the wind and songs sung among the stars. Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
I enjoy making tanka songs, putting tanka together, and kind of creating
that. Do you have some of those on your website?
I don't, no. So did you enjoy that?
Yes.
Yes. I want to move on now to a form that evolved all of this. So you see this weaving together of tanka. And one of the things that emerged from that is a form called Renga. We have another Renga poet here, so good friend Pat. And Renga means linked verse. It actually means linked elegance. And it is a series of images, you know, like that are linked together, and it emerged out of this tankara context, you know, like particularly the what I read in the Kokenshu, that kind of weaving together, because normally renga are written by groups of poets. There are solo renga. And I'm going to read one of my solo renga. It's a 12-verse form called the Shisan. And I'll just read it, and then we can talk a little bit about it. I was recently in Santa Cruz, and I wrote this. It's called A Single Blossom. Santa Cruz Harbor, the sound of barking seals in the morning fog. Summer heat pushes people to the California coast. Watching the sunset, newlyweds are holding hands on the balcony. A power outage has occurred, but nobody seems to mind. The moon is rising over the distant mountains in the cool fall air. She adjusts the thermostat to a much lower setting. We should concentrate. We are blowing our budget. Where is it going? He puts the folders away and gazes out the window. Relentless winds blow, whistling through the power lines past the frozen pond. A diner prepares coffee in the early morning light. The hawthorn blossoms, white with a tinge of yellow, bright against the leaves. She plucks a single blossom and places it in her hair. Think of a renga as a journey. So you're taking a journey, right? So think of a journey down the Russian River. Right? So you're going down the Russian River, and every time you take that journey down the Russian River, you see the same things. You know, like, but every time you take it, those same things are a little different. So what renga is defined, you know, it's 5-7-5-7-7. There's this, that, you know, that structure there, but there are also certain sites in a renga. And the renga, a renga is a journey, and there are certain topics that have to be mentioned on the journey. You know, like, so you have to mention the moon, you have to mention love at some point, you have to mention blossoms of some kind. You know, like, and they have to be, you know, they have to be placed at certain points. It's not quite as rigid as I'm making it sound. You know, like, although I think in Japan it probably is that rigid. But so the renga journey is this journey. You know, like. The images are linked, but there's also a shift, like going down a river. You know, like you see a field, and then you see a cabin, and then you see a forest. And the cabin is linked to the field and the forest, but the forest isn't linked to the field. You know, like what weaves them together is the journey itself. You know, like, so like here, relentless winds blow, whistling through the power lines past the frozen pond. That's a winter verse, yeah? Mm-hmm. A diner prepares coffee in the early morning light.
Sorry. I forgot to turn it off.
The hawthorn blossoms, white with a tinge of yellow, bright against the leaves. So the middle verse, a diner prepares coffee in the early morning light, links to the winter verse, but it also links to the spring verse. You know, like, so it functions as a verse pivot between the two seasons. Similarly to the way the pivot functions in the tanka for the above and below.
And that's common.
What?
A pivot verse is common.
It's a rule.
It's a rule.
It's not just, you're supposed to link. One of the tricks of renga is that it's not supposed to be narrative. You're not supposed to be telling a story. You know, like, so you. Yeah.
So each he and she in this cycle is a different he and she. Would that be
inferred? Yeah, it's like she decides not to turn on the television or answer the phone, watching the full moon rising in the crisp, clear fall air. He remembers how, when he was a little boy, he talked to the clouds. That's considered a shift from she to he, and the verse between can link to either one of them.
Now, if that were a Japanese poem, if there are pronouns, do you know if it's a male or female character?
No, and they use that. I mean, that's one of the techniques in Japanese. They can have a verse that will link, and the it'll be understood to be she, you know, from the verse above, and then the verse below, they can shift it to a he, or even a we, you know, like, because pronouns are used so rarely. English doesn't have that capacity, you know, for the most part, you know, like, except if you deliberately structure it that way. There some Renga poets, like my good friend Pat, and his fellow Rengoids.
Haikai poets.
Will repeat the verse. Mm-hmm. And given the Japanese precedence, the he might be changed to a she in the repetition to link to the next one. Or a we, yes, or singular to plural.
It's up to the next poet in the sequence to determine if that's going to be a he or a she, or depending on the personal pronoun, and you can also, there are other things that you can shift. And I think that's primarily because of the ambiguity of Japanese language. Our language doesn't have that kind of ambiguity.
Right.
And the main person that we take our ideas about haikai, our Earl Minor, and so we read his translations, and he points out those ambiguities in the language, and so we have adapted them and synthesized them into the way we write.
Yeah.
I got it.
So, Renga is very new in the United States also. The first magazine devoted to Renga was in the mid-80s, published humbly by me. Yeah, like, and so it doesn't have a long history. I mean, there are many earlier examples of Renga, but for one thing, it's a complex form. But I believe the complexity of Renga is exaggerated. You know, like, I think it's about as complex as a sonnet. I mean, a classical sonnet. You know, like, if you stick to all the rhymes and all the that sort of thing. You know, like, so, thank you.
Sorry, I'm going to turn it off.
I'd like to conclude this evening with a final Renga. During the great classical period of Japanese Renga, the standard form was 100 verses. Like, and my favorite Renga poet is Sogi, and he wrote only in the 100-verse form, which is called Hyakuen. I think that's right.
Yes.
And inspired by Sogi, I wrote this 100-verse Renga called 100 Verses at Sebastopol. Right. And it's in 8 sections, and I ring the bell between each section to give us a little pause. This April morning, before the sun has risen, brief, cool spring showers. I walk through the silent house, a shadow among shadows. Birds migrating north find their way between the clouds and the horizon. Picking up friends on the way, clusters of young school children. The waitress pauses, scanning the new customers, then fixes her smile. At the end of a long day, by herself on a park bench, a first quarter moon hovering near Jupiter caresses the sky. He clears the dinner table. It's son number two's turn. Blue jays repairing the same nest they used last year and the year before. The entire forest bows to the mountain deity. He observes the time, wish me luck, said in a rush as he leaves for work. The sun on its journey south is crossing the equator. Autumn in the sky, but the leaves have not yet turned, though the grass is brown. But there is a hint of cold, particularly at night. The days grow shorter and the shadows seem darker and life feels faster. Do insects at night know they are singing their last song? Libra holds the moon, which seems to halt on its path until a cloud clears. She just can't make up her mind which courses to take this year. A dog starts to bark and hears its owner calling, turns and runs inside. On the other hand, he says, I do not see it that way. Thick golden yellow, the acacia in bloom, allergy season. She's planting native species in the redesigned garden. Cutbacks by the board, a public corporation, leads to more litter. DVDs fill the bookshelves, Star Trek, Buffy, TNG. Mom raises her voice. Have you finished your homework? But it's Friday night. Finally free of parents, they meet as planned at the mall. They were friends of friends. They didn't know each other the first night they met. It's such a delight to see the face one loves approaching. An awkward moment, one has nothing left to say, boredom in her eyes. Into the silence one speaks and right away feels regret. Now we have to part. It didn't start out that way. When did things go wrong? Fired from his job today, he feels oddly elated. All those pair of feet on the stairs of the subway, where are they going? But if you ask me, she says, you can't trust any of them. May evenings are cold, and they sure last a long time waiting for the bus. The barest sliver remains just before the new moon's time. Bats in ghostly flight across the star-covered sky to the farmer's fields. Creatures of the realm of night, a world hidden by our dreams. Trucks in the distance, a highway through the valley from places unknown. Snails leave tracks in the window, traces of their wanderings. In the summer heat, I saw the mayflies dancing in a ray of light. Two dogs napping in the sun, their owner waters potted plants. Good morning, neighbor. I brought you some cucumbers and some tomatoes. In the refrigerator, there's enough food for 5 days. Counter cat watching as canned tuna gets added to the tossed salad. Brisk winds pushing the thin clouds past the face of the full moon. Bathed in the moonlight, rabbits are bowing deeply to the sky above. Autumn evenings are quiet compared to spring or summer. A vase of flowers seems especially fragile at this time of year. It's not the vase that's fragile, it's the flowers in the cold. So many acorns from the branches of the oak, two or three may sprout. Just halfway across the field, a cluster of red madrones. Do you think that trees are conscious of each other? Do they have feelings? She asks her neighbor and friend as they watch their children play. I wonder if I should work. We really need the money. Fertilizing the garden from the kitchen compost heap. Tea leaves harvested on the Himalayan slopes and farms in Taiwan. A warm cup of Darjeeling served in a London tea room. Two old friends sit down, sharing their respective weeks, the time of their lives. At the local garden club, showing off their best flowers. These Gemini days, everything is fresh and full, new and different. Pine incense purchased today slowly fills the quiet room, while moonlight gathers in the deep pools in the corners, a child sings a rhyme. The goddess of summertime dances in the solstice night. Clear December skies, scientists take careful notes, vanishing glaciers. Mountaintop meadows are dry, wind blows dust to the valleys. The sluggish river, gossamer clouds in the night, and no August wind. It is grandmother's birthday, time for family history. But these two cousins only see each other's eyes, hear each other's breath. Behind the wooden garage, experimental kisses. 20 years later, at grandfather's funeral, memories bring smiles. I remember it clearly. It was a night just like this. A full summer moon seems to race across the stars beside the airplanes. Heat in deep February, yields long and dreamless evenings. Magnolia blossoms, their intoxicating scent saturates the room. A cup of warm spearmint tea after the meditations. Thick blankets piled high on frigid August mornings are such a comfort. She'd really like to linger and put a few hours on hold. What would it be like to remember all the things seen by a mountain? Yet even they are like dust in the cosmic tides of time. Almost all life forms that have breathed upon the earth have become extinct. I met the god of rivers. He was thousands of years old. Yosemite cliffs, two lovers walking hand in hand on the valley floor. The steady October wind bends the long grass in the fields, rocks in the garden, watch day and night come and go, and the seasons flow. Earthrise on the distant moon, an astronaut stands in awe. A small pale blue dot, the mother of all of us, sails through the void. Sand dunes in a vast desert shift a little month by month. Buried in a jar during a time of turmoil, an ancient codex. In the middle of the night, the slow chanting of the psalms. Rippling silver light from the half-full waxing moon cools the summer air. A content coyote strolls past the suburban houses. It is 3 p.m. The light of the sun seems harsh in a traffic jam. Isn't technology grand while putting on sunglasses? Sometimes we forget the world is more than human. More than you and I. Darkness of a full eclipse while dragons fly through the sky. Falling from heaven, celestial flowers rain upon those who love. Suddenly, a strong breeze melts the snow and warms the air. Overnight they bloomed, the cherry trees have blossomed, a dazzling display. What are you listening to? The song that is sung by time.
Thank you very much. Oh, wow.
So that's my a little bit about Tanka, a tiny bit about Renga. You know, like I say, it's a huge subject, and I hope you enjoyed this evening. And I want to thank everybody for coming. And there are books on Tanka. Waka and Renga for sale on our table by the entrance. And I'm happy to stay here and linger and talk to people afterwards. Once again, thank you very much for coming. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
I think it would be good for you to mention your website and your blog.
My blog. I have a blog called Renga Roads. RengaRoads.blogspot.com. And I also have, on Wacko BB, I have a thing that I call Tanka River, where several times a week I put up a Tanka. Most of them are by me, but I also like to put up other people's Tanka and review some Tanka books that are being published. There's a lot being published today, on Tanka. It's, and Pat, would you tell them where your Tanka are available?
At Quicksilver Mine Company.
In Forestville?
They've got a selection of books in one area, but the Tanka books are behind the desk because they're limited editions. So
so go to Quicksilver and ask for the behind the counter Tanka.
Right. They're in a brown paper.
So Pat has been a big help to me. He's been a great help to me in my own writing, and I really urge you to check out his poetry at Quicksilver Mining Company.
I'll have to publish some non-limited editions and leave them here for...
That would be wonderful.
Yeah. Okay.
Thanks again, everybody.
And we have, as usual, I'll just point out the donation bowl over here, which we split with our speaker and used to sustain this space. Thanks. thank you so much for coming tonight, and we look forward to seeing you again.